Support comes from Austin Water's WaterWise Landscape and Rainscape programs for customers replacing water-thirsty lawns with drought-tolerant native plants. Applications and program information at austinwater.org.
From KUT and KUTX Studios.
And welcome to This Song, the podcast where artists talk about the songs that changed their lives and give us a glimpse into their creative process. We here at Team This Song are on vacation, so we're taking a break from new episodes just for this week, but we wanted to give you this rerun of an episode we did with Eric Early and Brian Koch from Blitz and Trapper. They're coming to our fair city of Austin, Texas on Thursday, February 22nd to play Antones as part of our 5th birthday series here at KUTX. Yes, KUTX, the radio station where we make this podcast, is going to turn 5 years old, and we're going to spend all of 2018 celebrating. You should totally come to the show at Antones. You can find details at the events page of our website, kutx.org. Now, Blitz and Trapper are a Portland-based band. They've been bringing their Americana-tinged rock to the people since the mid-2000s. They have a new album out called Wild and Reckless, and it's both straight ahead and weird at the same time. And that mix of traditional and, like, darkly idiosyncratic is something that singer-songwriter and guitar player Eric Early has been into for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think. I mean, I grew up listening to just like whatever my parents listened to, you know.
Yeah.
A lot of folk music and then some church music and stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, I guess in high school when I was a freshman, I just have such vague memories of that time. But at some point I heard an R.E.M. song, I think, because they were my favorite band. And they're the ones that kind of turned me into someone that listened to rock on like a fan level instead of just like, oh yeah. It was probably something Out of Time, because that came out when I was a freshman.
So Out of Time, that's the one with Losing My Religion?
Yeah, it's their huge record, you know, the one that breaks through, really.
Oh, life is bigger. It's bigger than you.
Were you watching MTV? Because I remember that was just a big, like,
no, we didn't
MTV
have cable.
Presence. Oh, whoa, right on.
Yeah, oh, we never had cable when I was a kid. We had, like, 3 channels.
Oh, wow. Even in the, like, early 90s.
Yeah, there was probably 5 channels by then.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you probably, do you think you heard it on the radio, or did a friend give
it to
you?
Yeah, it would have been the radio. It would have been the radio and then a friend. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had this buddy named Josh back then, who was a couple years older, and he was into a lot of like 80s punk and rock stuff that I wouldn't have ever heard, you know, the kind of stuff that back then, the only way you'd know about it was by, you know, having older brothers and stuff like that, which I didn't have.
Right. Oh, I mean, because there was
no internet.
Yeah.
there was no internet. Yeah, I don't even know how people would find out about records back then, other than you just go into the record store and look at the titles and the pictures and be like, oh, that's a cool picture, you know?
Yeah, or, I mean, I didn't have any older siblings, but I did have, like, a cool older friend who
right.
introduced me to, like, The Cure and Depeche Mode and R.E.M., and so...
That's exactly what I had. He's my buddy Josh, yeah. And he introduced me to The Cure.
Show me how you do that trick. The one that makes me scream, she said. The one that makes me laugh, she said.
And R.E.M., and Replacement, Pavement, yeah, all that stuff. And the funny thing is that I could relate to it somehow, just like dumb, you know, kid from this backwater state, backwater town. But, you know, I was like, and I think the reason R.E.M. resonated was because it had sort of these country elements to it. There's pedal steel. There was stuff that I knew and understood, you know.
Did you grow up listening to it? You said folk and some church music, but was country in there too?
Yeah, country music, folk music, and more kind of just the, you know, because my dad was into like Count Van Zandt, John Prine, Bob Dylan.
Oh, real singer-songwriter. Like,
yeah, more singer-songwriter, more kind of lyrical-based type stuff. And then he was also into like old, you know, Doc Watson and stuff.
Blue railroad train and going down the railroad track. It makes me feel so doggone blue to listen to that old smokestack. Drivers are rolling on, leaving me here behind. Give me back them good old days and let me ramble down the line.
Yeah, I think I started playing the banjo at about 5. Because it's a smaller neck.
Right.
My dad taught me to finger pick when I was really young. Basically, as soon as I could actually do it.
Oh.
Taught me the different picking patterns, Travis pick and some of the other stuff.
And so by the time you were in high school and you heard REM, you were pretty probably adept musically. Like, you understood theory and you could play a bunch of instruments.
I didn't necessarily understand theory. I did a little bit because I had some lessons. I understood more just sort of the way the whole thing worked. And also I was playing along to records a lot of the time, all kinds of records, you know, Christian records, church records. Old Crosby, Stills, and Nashville to Reels, 8 tracks of like Bob Dylan. You know, I would just play along to whatever crap was laying around. So that way I learned a lot, probably the most actually.
One morning I woke up and I knew it was wrong. A new day, a new way, and new eyes were strong.
And so what was it about REM, like, as opposed to everything else that you had heard before? Because you were exposed to a lot of, like, serious, good, deep music. And then you hear REM, and there was something, there's something you can touch, like, reach back and touch into the country elements. But what was new about it? Like, what hit you?
I mean, because I think it was rock, but it wasn't super hard. It wasn't like metal. Like, I never really had too much of a metal phase. You know, it was more just like, oh, yeah, this is rock, but there's also these country elements. And then lyrically, I just really liked his lyrics because they were vague and they were always talking about sort of these kind of weird, strange, decaying sort of environments and images and stuff. I think it more than anything just reflected on the place I grew up in.
Oh, how so?
I mean, I think that Michael Stipe was always writing about the South and its sort of decay.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of the darkness of it. And Oregon was basically the exact same thing back in the 80s and early 90s.
Really?
You know, no one had moved there yet. No one lived there. It was 10 years behind everywhere else. And where I grew up was just this little, it was Salem. And I grew up north of town in a place called Hayesville.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it was literally just backwater. Like, there was no fashion. There was no, I mean, we would find music 5-6 years later, you know. It was kind of like one of those places, and for me, the music of REM, it just made sense in that place, you know. I mean, there was a whole waterfront area that was derelict, filled with old train cars that people lived in, like homeless people lived in. And,
oh, wow.
I mean, it was just a place that was cool, and we would ride our bikes around, and, you know, it was just farmland, and then old, you know, the city was kind of falling apart at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the late 90s, that all started to change, you know, and then, you know, in the last 6-7 years, it's completely changed. And the place I grew up in is gone. You know, it's built over.
This could be the saddest dusk you've ever seen. Turn to a miracle. I'm alive. My mind is racing. As it always will. My hands tired, my heart aches.
You were playing a bunch of instruments when you heard REM, and you kind of related, it sounds like you related really to the sounds, but like a lot to the lyrics and a lot to the lyrical content.
I think lyrically, I always looked to Michael Stipe's lyrics, their vagueness, their art, their poetry, you know, because his lyrics were poetry. They weren't so much just straightforward love song, you know, this or that, like you'd hear in Top 40 radio. It was like these weird, strange, dark tales, you know? You're like, what is he talking about?
And obtuse. I mean, it's really,
yeah.
It's really hard to,
I mean,
to
they
like...
had their hits. They had their hits, too. I mean, Shining Happy People.
Shining Happy People, laughing.
stand in the place where you live.
Stand in the place where you were. Now face well. Think about the place,
you know, and that was the thing, I think. He could write hip, but he could also write these really dark, obtuse songs where you're just like, man, that's so cool, you know?
And was there a particular song from that record that you were like, that one? Like, Losing My
Religion?
Yeah,
there was a couple. No, there was a couple, like, the more obscure songs. Like the song Country Feedback. I just love that song.
I was central. I had control. I lost my head. I need this. I need this. Paperweight. Junk garage, winter rain, a honey pot, crazy, all the lovers have been tagged.
And the song Low.
You and me, we know about time, we know how things go, they come.
Another two dark, dark, you know, deep cuts of the record that most people probably haven't even heard, but they were just great pieces of just, you know, early American, you know, 90s Americana, basically.
Yeah. So it sounds like around this time, around 14, that was when you kind of got into rock. Like,
yeah.
You went from country and folk and, like, playing banjo and slide guitar to, like, did you pick up an electric guitar around that time?
And well, then... I got my first electric when I was, like, nine or ten. Just like an old, not old, it was new, but it was just like a crappy $200 butt rock guitar. It was an 80s guitar. I mean, it was 1986 or something.
Yeah.
85, you know. But then in about 89, my dad bought me a 1972 Fender Telecaster, which is a real guitar.
How old were you when you got a 72 Telecaster?
I was 15. And back then, of course, it was only $500. This guitar had been owned by one of the Doobie Brothers. I mean, it was like a real guitar. It was a great guitar. It was a custom. And, you know, the guy that ran the guitar shop in town was buddies with my dad. They went to the same church.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's like, oh, you got to come down and check out this guitar and buy it for Eric. So he did. And, you know, that's when I really started to play. And it was around the same time that I started getting into all these bands. And so, yeah, I had a really good guitar, and I was getting into rock music, and that's kind of what happened.
Oh, it's like a perfect storm of like getting a really good instrument, because there is something different about a really playing on a really good instrument. I mean, it opens up a whole nother side of playing and getting a really good instrument, hearing the right kind of music. It all kind of happened around the same time, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Blitz and Trapper drummer Brian Koch, on the other hand, was inspired by someone a little closer to home.
Well, this might be sort of a non-traditional sort of response, but when I think of why I started or how I started getting involved in playing music, I go all the way back in my mind to high school when I was burning for years to play and my family refused to let me have any rock instrumentation because of its satanic overtones. Starting from a very early age, I got all my music, not secretly, but just kind of on the down low off of the radio. I was like an insomniac even as a little kid, just recording. I'd have a cassette ghetto blaster up next to my head behind the pillow, and I had it on record with the pause engaged, and I'd wait for the song that I wanted to hear, and as soon as it played, I'd unpause it, and I'd make my own mixtapes that way.
You would do that late at night?
Yeah.
Such a thing. How old are you?
Now?
Yeah.
I'm 40.
You're 40. So I'm 38, and I did the exact same thing where you would put the tape in and you would turn on your radio station and then you would wait for the song.
And this is before, obviously, I was old enough to be a working teenager, so I didn't really have money. And
could you have gone out and bought that music?
Even if
I had the money?
No. And, I mean, some of it, because some of it was pop. I mean, as a kid, I loved everything. I would listen to New Kids on the Block on the radio. I'd listen to the rock stations, kind of whatever.
Oh, you love the right stuff, baby. Love the way you turn me on. You got the right stuff.
Yeah.
My family really only owned, like, My father's collection was mostly big band music and predominantly lame. You know, I like big band music, but it was, you know, stuff that I would never listen to as a kid.
Like Glenn Campbell,
or Smothers Brothers, yeah, you know, stuff that was just not for me.
Galveston, oh Galveston, I still hear your sea winds blowing. Still see her dark eyes glowing. She was 21 when I left Galveston.
And the good music that we had belonged to my mom. She had like the Eagles, and she would buy the occasional record for the kids, but my dad was dead set against it. In fact, at some point he burned a bunch of the records.
Your mom's records?
Yeah.
Ooh, witchy woman. See how high she flies. Ooh, witchy woman, she got the moon in her eye.
Wow.
Yeah, it was pretty contentious.
That's intense.
And so I had to do a lot of it on the sly. And like.
And did you play music?
Well, like, I played clarinet because I wasn't allowed to play the evil saxophone.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Really?
Despite it having the exact same fingerings. My father, I think he was just under the impression that sax was evil because it was the accompaniment to so much rock and roll in the 80s.
Well, he's definitely right that, like, sax would probably lead to...
And it sounds like sex?
Yeah, it sounds like sex. It's probably, it's like, will lead to iniquity. Yeah. Clarinet's probably not going to...
Yeah, he was worried that I would get involved in some kind of sax crime. I think in high school I started hanging out with friends who played because that was the only way I could be near instrumentation like that.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of my friends were pretty well off, and their families would buy them guitars if they wanted to. And around 14 or 15, my friends started putting together bands. And I think it was when I was 16, my junior year of high school, I want to say, that some real good friends of mine put together a band. One of the bands was called Havoc Cow.
Havoc Cow.
But they would obviously just say Havoc Cow. And they all, you know, could play pretty rudimentary grunge rock pretty well, and it blew my mind. And I had never seen anybody in my peer group play rock music before, and it totally broke my brain because I was like, this is actually possible. Like, these guys haven't been playing very long, and they're really, like, to my mind then, very good, and they're playing, you know, in these, like, classrooms in school after school. And they even played at some concerts, and it's like, so it was within maybe a year and a half of that I met Eric, and I got some of his demos, and was astounded that he was playing this really advanced, quieter melodic music that I wasn't really into at the time, like more REM and 10,000
right.
Maniacs style. And it was so good. It really set me on a different direction, paying more attention to melody. And then I ended up playing in my first band as a bass player with Eric, who's the singer of Blitz and Trapper.
Whoa.
I was 18 and he was 16.
All the kids are sitting still, strapped inside the Ferris wheel. Wonder what they're gonna feel when they start to turn.
So it was actually like Eric's music that kind of like.
It was he was the first songwriter that I played for. Yeah.
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 That's
at 18 years old.
That's pretty incredible. So how did you like finally decide to make the leap, like to break away from what your parents were kind of putting down? Like, what was it, a thing, or was it just like this is so good, I just want to do this?
When I was 17, I started sneaking a guitar into the house and. Playing it on headphones so that nobody could hear me, you know, trying to learn Nirvana songs and stuff.
Yeah.
But eventually they saw it, obviously, heard it a little bit, and they were like, this has got to go. My dad had previously said if I brought an electric guitar in the house, he'd burn it. And he didn't. I called his bluff, and he backed off. And so I just kept it and started learning how to play that, got an acoustic, got a bass. Bass was my first instrument in a band. Mm-hmm. And then, it just kind of started to slowly snowball from there. And I would say as a side note, the other thing, too, besides those bands that really inspired me was seeing a high school production of Into the Woods, where all my peers were also doing this amazing musical.
Mother cannot guide you. Now you're on your own. Only me beside you. Still you're not alone. No one is alone. Truly, no one is alone. I wish.
Were they in the pit band or like on stage?
The actual actors.
Okay.
And acting is another thing that I do and that I've always been interested in. But it was seeing Into the Woods, seeing my peers do it and do it well. I thought that yeah. That really inspired me just to start performing and to get out of my shell.
So it was really coming across people who were your age, mm-hmm. who were doing what mm-hmm. you had this burning desire to do.
Yeah.
And like when you saw them doing it, it was like, wait a second. Like if they can do it.
Yeah. Damn the consequences. I have to do this.
Wow. And it made you bold enough to stand up to your father who sounds like he could be kind of a scary dude.
Well, it wasn't that he was scary. It was just invasive and lame. He's come around in the intervening years. I'm pretty sure he had a moment where he saw us playing Conan O'Brien and I didn't tell him that we were playing. He didn't know.
Oh, he just came across it?
We had stopped talking about music because it was such a point of contention.
Oh, wow.
And he was literally lying in bed at night and saw it was channel surfing and came across me playing drums on the Conan. And I think that it sort of shattered his preconceived notions that were pretty much religious. But I think also at the heart of it, I think he was just worried that I was setting myself up for a life of poverty, which I have, but that doesn't mean I'm unhappy.
I know. Well, that's the trade-off is you get to play music, yeah. which is like the beautiful thing.
Yeah.
Like, do you still have any of that early
I certainly do.
Music? Do
yeah.
you think you could send it to me so I could put it in the podcast if he was okay with it?
I could ask him, yeah.
That would be cool yeah. because it would be cool to hear, you know, what you heard. And what kind of made you think, like, I want to...
I don't know that I have the actual cassette that he gave me that had the demos, but I have the first record that band made, and a lot of those, there's, like, I think 6 or 7 songs on it, and some of those songs were, demoed in that cassette.
Yeah.
But I certainly have a ton of that stuff. It's, like, it's in a shoebox that's labeled the last cassettes on the earth.
Cassettes on the earth.
Yeah, and it's got a lot of old throwback stuff on there. It'll be one day it'll be at least blackmail material or something.
Well, I really love that. I love the seeing. I mean, there is nothing more powerful than seeing other people do it.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it really is why I'm here, I think, doing what I'm doing.
Totally.
I needed somebody else to sort of pioneer the way for me.
Well, you have to know it can be done.
Yeah.
You know, like you have to know that it's a possibility. And I think so often, like, when we think of music and musicians, it's, like, super famous people who are way, way out of our reach, who it's hard to relate to.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very easy to relate to, like,
yeah.
my friends up on yeah. stage or my friends playing in a classroom after school.
Yeah.
Like, this is a thing. Let's,
yeah,
let's
and
do
I,
it.
And I think on a couple occasions with those gentlemen, I've tried to communicate to them over the years upon running into them, like, maybe you don't realize how important it was that you did what you did, but... It was really inspiring. And they were all just kind of shrugged it off, like, oh, whatever.
Maybe you can send them this podcast episode and be
yeah.
like, seriously, guys.
Yeah.
Like, for
yeah.
real.
Yeah.
Here it is.
Yeah. Thank you, guys. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you coming in and talking.
Of course.
I can't wait to cut this together. So,
cool.
Thanks a lot.
Well, we danced in the back of the pickup truck till the sky turned to roses. Then we drove into town and we danced some more till the barrooms all were closing. And that red dress, baby.
And this is Wild and Reckless from the new Blitz and Trapper album of the same name. And hey, New Year's Eve is right around the corner. I hope you get a little wild and reckless. And I'll see you at Antone's on February 22nd. We'll watch Blitz and Trapper together and celebrate KUTX's fifth birthday. And it'll be awesome. You can find the details at KUTX.org. And that's it. You've come to the end of another episode of This Song. This Song is a production of KUTX 98.9 in Austin, Texas. This episode was produced and edited by David Sanger and me, Elizabeth McQueen. The interview with Brian was recorded by Cliff Hargrove, and the interview with Eric Early was recorded by David Alvarez. Aaron Waltz is our social media intern. Kelly Seal is our excellent intern. And thanks to Deidre Gott and Peter Babb and Todd Callahan for all they do for this podcast. And yes, it is true, our theme song is Mahout by Austin's own Hard Proof. Right on. Happy New Year. Talk to you next time.